I'm Brian.
I'm Griff.
And this is the eBay for Business podcast, your source for the information and inspiration we hope to help you start, manage, and grow your business on the world's most powerful marketplace. This is episode 263. Well, look at you, Brian. How have you been?
I've been well. It was a restful week after a busy eBay open week, which was absolutely fabulous. But this week was kind of busy catching up on stuff. And getting ready, actually, I must say, for next week. I will be in Las Vegas for a few days, and so will you, at Boss Reseller Remix.
Wait a minute, is it next week? Because I'm going too for two nights.
You are. Yeah, it'll be good. I'm looking forward to seeing the sellers, and Adam's going to be there for a day. If sellers haven't gone or haven't registered and you're in the Vegas area, I encourage you to look up Boss Reseller Remix and register and come by for Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Yeah, stop by the eBay booth.
Yes.
This will be a chance to meet sellers and maybe book them into a future episode.
Cool.
Yeah, should be fun.
It will be. I always like seeing sellers.
And there'll be a lot of them there.
There will be. How's your week gone?
I just got out of the pool before we started recording.
Oh, lucky you.
And the pool is nice and cool, so it was really refreshing.
You don't have a heater for your pool.
Nah, I don't want a heater. I like ice cold water.
That New England upbringing.
There you go. Jumping right into the Atlantic. You know, it builds character growing up in the Northeast. The Northeast.
Does. I inherited it from my parents.
You certainly did. You probably want to ask me who our guest is.
Who is our guest this week, Griff?
Oh, I'm glad you asked, because this week we have a seller named Tate Hudenpyle, and I think if you were at eBay Open, you may have attended his session. He has a store on eBay called Hoodies Collectibles. It's trading cards. We're going to talk to him about his take on eBay Open, what his experience was like, and also about his business. But before we do that, it's time for the news, and then I have a little thing I want to talk about. So what do you got for the news this week, Brian?
Now I'm curious about what else you have.
Oh, I'm sure.
So the big news this week is all about the 2023 eBay Small Business Report, which was released last Wednesday, September 27th, at a Washington Post live event in Washington, D.C. eBay CEO Jamie Iannone attended the event along with eBay seller Angie Cardona Nelson. There was a panel discussion moderated by Fast Company Editor-in-Chief Brendan Maughan. You can read the entire 2023 eBay Small Business Report on the eBay Inc. blog at www.ebayinc.com.
And I went through it, and it's pretty interesting. I think if you sell on eBay and you're interested in business, check it out and read through it. There's some interesting insights. Brian, before we meet our guest, I kind of teased this, but I wanted to share something I discovered in my eBay recently, which I had no idea existed previous, and I stumbled upon it. And I'm wondering if a lot of other sellers might not know it exists.
Now I'm nervous. What'd you come across?
Well, no. It's actually something good. If you go to my eBay and then click on the account tab, over on the left-hand column, there's a column called personal information, which I think a lot of sellers are paying attention to right now, but we'll talk about that later. If you look at the last link in that column, there's a link called Request Your eBay Data. And I had never seen this before. And I'm thinking, what is this? So I tried it out.
And
it's pretty cool. So you can create or customize a report and you can set a window to go back. You can get a download of things like your purchases, transactions, your orders, your feedback history, your dispute and returns history, all these different options for tailoring this report. So I tried one, and I went back to 2017 to see how much information can I get in this report that I can't normally get from, like, transaction reports or anything else. And it was pretty cool. It took 1 week for me to get that email that said your report is ready, and I downloaded it, and it's a zip file, and I unzipped it, and it's interesting format because what it is that it's a HTML formatted pages. So you have to click on, like in the old days, you click on index.
So it's not like a CSV file.
No, it's not a CSV file. You click on index and it displays in your web browser a page that you can then navigate from. And then you can print them as PDF if you need them. It was very interesting. My sales or orders only go back 2 years, but the purchases showed my purchases back to 2017.
Oh, interesting. Almost 6 years of purchases.
Exactly, which was kind of crazy. If you've never done this before, it only takes a few seconds to set up, and then you wait for a week for it to be generated. But this is pretty interesting stuff.
Is this new? Or is it just one of those things that got added? And
well, it must have got added at some point, but no one told us.
Yeah, we never advertised it. I wonder if any of our listeners have used it in the past.
Don't know.
And for what?
I wonder if the sellers, there's going to be some sellers who say, what, you didn't know about this? We've known about this for years. What are you, crazy? Don't you pay attention? Oh, you guys.
When I meet with sellers, I learn something new every day, and I often learn something new on this podcast.
Well, there you go. Check it out. Let us know what you think. It's, again, you go to my eBay account, and then look over in the left-hand corner where it says personal information. At the very bottom of the list of links, there's this little link. It's called Request Your eBay Data. You can make a bunch of reports, so you can have separate ones.
Now I'm interested in this page, and I'm going to run a report.
Check it out, and let us know what you think, podcast at ebay.com or 888-723-4630. So I think it's time to get to our guest, Brian.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear from Tate.
Our guest this week has been buying and selling trading cards on eBay for over 20 years, and he decided at one point to turn his hobby into a career way back in 2017 after finishing his time at Oregon State University, where he majored in business entrepreneurship. Tate Hootenpile moved back to his hometown of Portland, Oregon, and opened the first Hoodies Collectibles retail location, and he's here today with us to tell us all about how that business started and why. Welcome, Tate.
Yeah, you bet, Griff. Thanks for having me.
I don't mean to give away your entire history, and I hope my intro didn't do that, but I trust I left you something that you could tell us about your business and why you started it.
Yeah, so I've always been a huge baseball fan, specifically played baseball for a long time. But with that, I always collected cards really since I was 7. So just been a passion project. And like you said, studying entrepreneurship at Oregon State, I was really into cards at that time. My career was over because I realized I was never going to be on the cards. So I said, why not sell them, right? So
was there a certain time when you realized you weren't even going to make it into the minors? Is that what happened?
Well, I played college ball a little bit, not at Oregon State, elsewhere. But I had elbow issues. So I had a Tommy John surgery and then came off that, pitched a year, and then it snapped again on the mound. Just kind of moved on to other things.
I'm sorry. That happened.
Oh, it's okay. It could be worse.
You had cards on the side, but were you ever thinking about like a managerial or some other position in the baseball industry?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I always wanted to get into that. And, you know, I actually was working at a card shop during the summers after baseball was over. And that's kind of what introduced me thoroughly to the business in general. And I kind of put my own spin on it. So I, instead of starting with retail, I actually started with eBay and inherently consignment. And I met people through that shop where I started the consignment business in college.
We mentioned you turned this into a career back in 2017. I can't tell how old you are looking at you. You look pretty young, but I could be wrong. Can you give us where we are in the timeline here on the calendar?
Yeah. So I'm 29 years old, turned 29 in July. We started the first retail store in 2017, and that was kind of the start of really the kickoff of eBay as well. I was doing some eBay stuff, and I was doing the consignment about a year before that. But in 2017, the Hoodies Collectibles LLC was truly formed. And so that started with our first retail store, and we kind of leveraged and scaled the consignment through the store. And through the store and beyond now, we get a lot of consignment from the stores, but also from mail-ins and things along those lines.
Give us an idea. How big is Hoodies?
In what way?
The size of the business. I know you started it in 2017, so we're looking at 6 years later. How big is it?
We got 13 employees. We have 2 retail locations and then the auction house. So it's getting there.
I know that since the 80s, the trading card business has been pretty active. It was active before, but I mean, it really took off in the 80s. And there's a lot of competition. How did you manage to weather the competition and building this business?
It's really competitive in the auction business. First things first, with the retail, it's really just having the product. Right now, it's a balancing act with distributors and manufacturers to get product. It's very capital intensive. You got to put out a lot of money to get the product. It's expensive now too, but it's being able to keep up on that and sell things and offer those things to your buyers at a fair price. And they'll keep coming back and just building a good customer base. For consignment, it's really just been a service game. Getting people, I have really good employees, and I have one that communicates with all the consigners pretty much. And so it's just really communicating with people, forming relationships, getting cards up quickly for them. Speed to market is really, really important now in the sports card business because things fluctuate so much. Just being on the same page with our consigners, forming relationships, and they should never be nervous to reach out to us, and we just get things done quickly for them.
What type of consigners do you have if you had to segment that population, that demographic for your business?
Yeah.
And are some of them actually in the business themselves or are some of them just collectors? How does that work?
I think there's different segments. We get a lot of people that do group breaks, which is, you know, buying into a team and they virtually open them. And then they get the cards that are open that go to their team that they picked. And so they'll send those to us. Those are kind of, you know, the people that are, they're kind of having fun with just ripping things, and they get their hits and they just want to retain some of their value back. And so those are the people we want to get things up quickly for. Then we'll get collectors that have been collecting for a while and they're just looking to liquidate some things, either to buy something new or they're just done with the hobby. And then the third one is just the retail store people, the people that are in the store that are opening cards with us, and they're leaving them for us to consign for them so they can get some of their money back too.
So explain to our audience who may not know what this means when you say opening cards.
Literally, you know, what I was just talking about with the supply of what we call wax in the store, which are hobby boxes. People are opening them for all these new releases, and they're opening these packs and boxes in hopes to get a big hit. I hate to use the word gambling, but it's exactly what it is.
Well, it kind of is. Yeah, yeah. It's like a mystery box.
Exactly.
And the manufacturers know this.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Exactly. They're opening these boxes in hopes to pull a big hit. When that happens, they sell it with us and they do great and they make a lot of money on the opening. But when they don't, they want to retain some of the value back.
I see. So right. Okay.
It's the people buying the hobby boxes in the store.
It's one thing I've never collected in my whole life. What was the strategy of having a brick and mortar retail location? That's a lot of work and a lot of investment.
Yeah, it is. This wasn't, you know, the whole business model by any means, but being in a very competitive industry inherently with the auction business, we wanted to capture as much of the local market as we could for that. I mean, we've been able, you know, through word of mouth and also just advertising, but, you know, locally leveraging our retail location to really boost that business for ours. Coming into the store and dropping something off for consignment is so much better than mailing it and have to worry about the security on the way.
And then obviously it was successful enough, so you had two locations. Where's the second one? Is it also in Portland?
That's in Bend, Oregon.
Oh, which is a growing community.
It is, very much so. It's a really beautiful place. A lot of young families there, a lot of people moving both from California and places like that. And then our first location's in Beaverton, so that's by Nike. So we have a good clientele of, you know, sports fans. So
exactly.
It's not in Portland proper, but going back to why we did retail as well, having a retail location, you also get a lot of the business of people looking to sell their collections. Someone that's had a collection for years, they don't know what to do with it. We can go to their house and we can buy those collections. And then, of course, the obvious reason, the retail setting, there's money to be had in buying and selling wax, the hobby boxes.
Why are they called wax?
That's just the industry term. Back in the day, if you remember, you know, like the Costco days, you're talking about the 80s and 90s earlier.
Yeah.
Remember the packs that were like wax packs? They felt like wax. So it stemmed from that.
No, I go back when there used to be bubble gum in the pack.
Yeah, that's that era. Yep, exactly.
And I was never a huge sports fan as a kid, so I was more interested in the bubble gum than the cards themselves.
Yeah, a lot of people were. Exactly. Yeah. That's the bike spoke thing.
How long after your first retail location opened did you open the store in Bend? Were you able to be more successful in opening that second location based on what you learned, I suppose, in the first one?
It's really knowing your clientele. Like I said, there's a lot of younger families in Bend. If you look at our customer from Beaverton to Bend, we get a lot of more, you know, middle-aged men in the Beaverton store. And then the clientele in the Bend store is a lot younger of a crowd. Instead of selling a $500 or $1,000 box of cards in Beaverton, we're selling more packs, you know, $10 to $15 price range in Bend. It depends.
If you had to break down the percentage of how much business you do inside the retail shops and online with eBay, how does that break down?
It's about 65-35 in favor of eBay. Yeah.
Really?
Maybe 70-30. Yeah, the stores do actually quite well.
That's fantastic. When you say auctions, you mentioned earlier, do you have your own auction company or is it something separate from eBay? Or does that mean the things you sell on eBay?
We have a website, hoodies.us, that's integrated with eBay. So everything's coded. We have an app that was done by a developer where you can watch all your auctions in live time. So if you can sign with us, you have your own portfolio that talks to eBay. There's hard code done on our end and through eBay as well. We ping eBay every like 20 minutes and everything updates with, you know, live auction bids and things like that. So people can actually view their items in live time and it's all hyperlinked to eBay's auction.
Is the software behind that something you guys created?
Yeah, I didn't create it. God, no, but I hired someone to do it.
Of course. I didn't mean you, Tate, personally. I forced you to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless you have the secret programming skill as well.
I wish I did. Let me tell you.
You mentioned your elbow. So when you were aspiring to play baseball, you were a pitcher.
Right.
And I'm sure you still follow the sport.
Oh, God.
Now, how much time do you spend doing that?
Not as much as I'd like. I'm from the Northwest. And I don't know if you've noticed, but the Mariners are quite good right now.
Yeah.
They're very, very good. So I'm following the Mariners very, very regularly, but I keep up with baseball every day.
Do the Mariners figure a lot in your own collecting? And by the way, do you have your own collection still?
I do. Yeah, absolutely.
This is the question that all my years in the antique business is that balance between being a dealer, a seller, and being a collector. And stuff comes into the shop and you go, I think I'll just put this aside.
It happens for sure. And actually, yeah, I collect Ken Griffey Jr. specifically. And then the other thing I'd collect, I do collect a little bit of Julio Rodriguez. I'm a believer in him. Lastly, I just collect vintage baseball, mostly signature stuff, some cards, but, you know, Babe Ruth autographs, things like that.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the most expensive card you've handled?
Well, we had a PSA 10 Jordan that came in that the guy, we put up on Buy It Now for him at the peak of the market when they're around $400,000. But he wanted to get $500,000 for it. And so we had it on Buy It Now for him for a long time. Didn't want to sell it. And then inevitably that card's gone down to $175,000. So we pulled it back and gave it to him. But as far as something that's actually sold from Upper Deck Retro of Wilt Chamberlain, a gentleman had it that he pulled back in 1999, kept it in a lunchbox. Those cards actually, that box came in a lunchbox. That was the whole marketing thing they were doing back then. And he pulled that card. It was number 13 and it graded a PSA 10. And we sold it for him for, I think, $180,000.
Wow.
And he just had it sitting.
A card that was published in 1999.
Yeah, that's Wilt Chamberlain. So he had that set and then Century Legends that he signed in and then he passed away. So there's only a couple versions of his autograph in Upper Deck products.
And this is the sad thing about celebrity autographs is once somebody passes away, everything increases in value.
Exactly. Yep. Especially Wilt.
Every field of collecting depends on new blood coming into the market. Is that part of your strategy? And if so, how do you market to young people to get them to consider purchasing cards?
That's really where the retail kicks in. With consignment and all that, inevitably you're dealing with a lot of adults. It's just the way it goes. They have more buying power. They're trying to move things around to create more buying power and all these things. So for kids, it's more about having a good shop experience. It's really the retail that comes into play more. We sponsor Little League teams. We have trade nights. And Topps, which is inherently Fanatics now, Fanatics is the parent company of Topps, they're doing a really good job at promoting just their brand with younger crowd. And I actually just did, eBay just came out to our shop and we were a part of their trade nights across the US and they put on a huge trade night and we had about 250 to 300 people come through. I'd say at least 50% of those were kids.
Well, that's good. You see them come in and you know, hey, I've got customers for life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and they're all hustlers. In our industry, there's the Pelican case, which is, you know, actually used for like pistols, but they carry these things around. They got expensive cards in there. They got $1,000 cards they're holding on to and trading amongst each other. It's just like, what's happening? I remember I was taking back 100 cans and that got me $5.
It's the entire collectible world, whether it's trading cards or watches or sneakers, obviously, where in the 80s, you might have bought a pair of sneakers for the street cred and you know, they were really special to you. And now it's all about value and worth. It's become a market.
It is. It has. Yep. Good point.
But there must be, I mean, do you ever see like young people come into the shop, for example, and what they're passionate about is the sport and not the fact that there is an investment opportunity?
Oh, for sure. There's so many kids that are really good with stats and they remember so many different things. There's still a lot of fans of the game kid-wise. I don't think as many as there used to be, but some of them are smart enough to realize that they're understanding these stats so they can leverage what they have or buy more things and try to predict the market. To be honest with you, the days of kids collecting to collect and, you know, have passion for the players, I don't think it's as relevant as it once was. Take it with a grain of salt because they're learning a lot of business ideas from a young age, which is great, which is valuable too.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. It would seem a shame if the passion for the business sort of overrode the passion for the sport itself, the art.
Right, exactly.
A lot of folks who listen to the podcast are not necessarily trading card sellers, but they will be exposed to having to purchase trading cards occasionally, whether it's at an estate sale or, you know, at a thrift store. They'll do the research. But what should people look out for when they're looking at cards that they may want to buy to resell on the marketplace?
If you're looking to resell, that's a tough one. I would recommend to people, don't look to resell. In today's age with cards, you have to buy something that you like. If you're looking to resell, you're going to have to inevitably deal with players that are current. You're buying Luka Doncic right now because you think he's going to have a great season and his stuff's going to appreciate 20 or 30%. But inevitably, that doesn't usually work anymore. There was a time a couple of years ago when that did. So what I tell people now is, you know, buy something you like, but also if you're looking to invest in something, look at it from a long-term perspective and buy, you know, vintage baseball, basketball, football, vintage style, all these guys that are proven. 2 years ago, Tom Brady's stuff was astronomical. It's come down a lot. I think there's no arguing that he's the best quarterback of all time, best football player of all time. Buying something like his and putting it away for a long period of time is going to be your best option.
If you're in the thrift stores and you see trading card collections, you know, do your research first. Nothing is a guarantee. And thrift stores and estate sales, well, not necessarily private people, will do a little research beforehand. So they may have an up on the value anyway. Well, we don't mean to discourage you. Do buy those cards for resale.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly, right. These series of interviews that you've heard during the last few weeks and the coming weeks were all recorded during what was called Seller Week, a month before eBay opened 2023, when we bring a lot of sellers onto the campus and we film the different segments for the online portion of eBay Open. I want to ask you, Tate, what are you doing this week for Seller Week?
I did an interview with Solim, which is our category manager for sports cards. So that was taped and everything. But really, it's getting the sense of community and meeting people in person. With an online business, it's kind of hard to meet people, right? Because you're online, kind of that sense of community. And that's why I came out and met a lot of different people, gained some new ideas. But yeah, just doing some filming here was the main reason.
There's about 30 or so sellers here this week.
I think there's exactly 30.
I was downstairs in the lobby when they were all coming in for the beginning of the day, and it was an enormous crowd, even though it looked like, supposedly it's just about 30 sellers. It looked like a lot of sellers who I knew. This is great to be here to do this, and I want to thank you for taking the time to spend time with us this week. I hope we can talk to you again.
Yeah, thank you, Griff. Thanks for having me.
We'll look forward to your third and fourth retail locations.
They're coming. Yep, they're coming.
Great. Tate Hudenpyle is the owner and CEO of Hoodies Collectibles, LLC. They have two retail locations, their own auction website. Everything is tied to eBay, and we'll put a link to his eBay store in the transcript for episode 263.
You got questions?
We got answers. Our first question was sent to podcast@ebay.com by an eBay seller named Kat. As always, do the honors and read our first question, Brian.
Happy to. Hello, gentlemen.
Who came in?
I hope you're doing well. My question is about listing vintage clothing.
Oh, no.
I know how Griff feels about that word.
No.
Yes, we all know how Griff feels about that word. But I apply the term to anything 20 or more years old. Currently, that would be anything produced in 2003 or prior. My question is, what is the best way to handle the brand field on eBay when a vintage garment has no tag or is a very obscure brand? So for example, if I have a sweater labeled Susie's of California and there are no active or sold listings with that brand, should I type in Susie's of California in the brand field or choose vintage as the brand? Or if it's a vintage garment with no tags, should I choose unbranded as the brand or vintage?
I'm going to pass out from the overuse of this word, but go on.
Regardless of what I type into the brand field, I always include the brand on the tag in the first sentence of my listing's description.
Yeah, and that's wasted, but go on.
I know as a buyer, if I'm looking for a classic sweater, I will often search on wool sweater and then use the brand filter to include brand equals vintage, along with checking off other brands like L.L. Bean, Ralph Lauren, J. Crew, etc. Purists would probably argue that we should enter the brand on the tag or unbranded if there is no tag, but that makes the item hard to find for people who want a mix of modern and vintage results, as the vintage equals yes-no filter would eliminate all the modern results, thus requiring them to perform one search for sweaters with vintage, yes, no, set to yes, and then a second search with the brand filter set to L.L. Bean, Ralph Lauren, J. Crew, etc. I hope my question makes sense. I want to do what's best for buyers and what will optimize my chances of appearing in search results. What does eBay recommend? Thanks for always providing great content. Kat, and her user ID is KatBuzzCo, B-U-Z-Z-C-O. Oh no, vintage, vintage, vintage. I had to throw it in there, Griff, just for you. That word again.
Yeah, I know. It's like an unending torture. I'll never get rid of it. It's always going to be haunting me.
Maybe you should put it on your tombstone. Here lies Griff, a real vintage guy.
You do, and I'll come back to haunt you.
I don't want to be haunted.
Wait, okay, then don't do this. I'm going to let you give your two cents first.
Well, Kat, in your example, you should type Susie's of California for brand, not vintage, since technically Susie's of California is the brand for the item and vintage is not the brand. It's a descriptor. And as you know, I believe a terrible one. only because I've learned from Griff.
I've taught him well. Kat, you're assuming that no one's looking for Susie of California. You have something rare, and there may be someone who's looking for that. So that's the brand. That's what it says on the label. That's what you put in the brand. You type it in, and then that way, if somebody is searching for that brand, they'll find it. Brian's right on this one, too. If an item of apparel is unbranded, well, then you go for the unbranded value. That's the one that eBay put in there, unbranded. And I know that if you go through all of the brands and apparel, because some people have been typing in vintage, that shows up as an option. Don't use it. If you want to indicate that your item is vintage, whatever the hell that means, because it means different things for different people, put it in the title. Say vintage something and do me a favor, throw me a fish here, put vintage and then maybe a year or a series of years or a decade where this it's vintage 1960s and then I'll feel better. Don't leave me hanging with that word. It doesn't mean anything. Anyway, if it's unbranded, then you should, and that means no brand at all, then you use unbranded, not vintage, not something else. People who are looking for unbranded items, of which there are a lot, they'll find it. If they're looking for something that's vintage, they'll find it because you put it in the title. But do not use vintage as a brand. Do not. Do not.
I would agree. And one other thing, Kat, buyers who are really looking for anything vintage, they'll put that term in the keywords they use to search. And that makes sense since nearly every single seller who uses the word vintage to describe something puts it in their item title and not in an item specific like brand.
Yeah. And in fact, using your strategy, I guarantee you as a shopper, you're missing more items that you may be interested in than are showing up in the search results.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah. So I would definitely not use unbranded if your label says Susie's of California. That's what it says on the label. Put it in the brand and never use vintage as a brand.
By putting it out there, you might get a good price for your item, which might set off a trend for Susie's of California. And hopefully you have other Susie's of California and people just didn't know how much they wanted it until you put it out there with the brand.
You have something so rare that there's no other example on eBay. Let's crow about that. Let's promote the fact that this is a one of a kind on eBay, Susie's of California. Susie, wherever you are, we love you. Make some more stuff.
Well, it's 20 years old. She may not be able to.
Well, she assumes it's 20 years old.
Yeah. That's true.
You know, and she says to Kat, vintage means 20 years. There's other people say, no, it's 30. There's some people say it's 15. There's no general consensus on what the word used alone means. You got me going down this rabbit hole. I said I don't care anymore. Hey, Kat, use vintage any way you want. I don't care anymore.
Dude, that was not convincing at all, Griff.
I'm trying my best, Brian, please. Our next question was emailed to podcast@ebay.com by seller John. And John says, hi, Brian. Hi, Griff. And hi, eBay. Is there a way to offer gift wrap as an additional service for an extra charge? He says, I actually enjoy gift wrapping packages. I'm a low volume seller. And when I started selling on eBay last year, I sometimes gift wrap cosmetics or small items. And one buyer messaged me and said it was the best customer service they ever received. The buyer's reaction encouraged me to sell more and helped me understand how eBay is such a special place to shop online. And if you'd like to see photos of my gift wrapping, I'm happy to provide those in a separate email.
And Griff, we used to have gift wrapping as an option, but no longer.
Yeah, it's correct. True. We did. There used to be an option for adding gift wrapping. You checked a little box and said it's an extra service. And I think it was a set price, maybe $1.50, something like that. And you could add that to an eBay listing where a buyer could opt for it. They could say, oh, and I want this gift wrap. But that, for some reason, don't ask me why, I have no idea, that was discontinued years ago. So currently, there's no option for gift wrapping as an added service. Now, a buyer can make a request for a separate service like gift wrapping in a message to you prior to purchase or in a buyer message section of checkout, which will show on your order invoice for that purchase, but there's no way to charge for it right now.
I have seen some sellers do extra listings where they'll have like a gift wrap listing and they'll in their description say, if you want this item gift wrapped, also go buy the gift wrap listing as well. The challenge with that is matching. So if you're a high volume seller, it likely will not work. But for someone who's lower volume, you might be able to match the two purchases together.
And they put it in a service category so they don't have to show shipping and tracking for that.
Exactly. Well, we have to give it to John. He's definitely customer service minded though, too.
Yeah, he is. And hey, kudos to you, John. And we're always happy to take a look at your gift wrapping skills. Just email them to us.
Well, here's a question that's been asked several times, including email to podcast@ebay.com. It's from seller Brett. Hello, Griff and Brian. I just want to say you both are awesome and I listen each week. Well, thank you, Brett. I have a question about the EU Digital Services Act. Oh, I think I'm going to leave this to you. As an American buyer seller, I can go to any of the eBay International sites. When this new act is made live, will I be able to see my business address as an American buyer going onto the eBay International site? Thanks, Brett. And Brett's eBay store is Treasure Time Trove. Griff?
So Brett, and for every other seller who may be asking the same question, the way it will work is if a seller makes their listings available to buyers in the EU, whether that's through eBay International Shipping or through their own international shipping, the seller's business information will be visible on each of the EU sites for that listing, and it will be available to anyone who goes to view it, whether they're a buyer in the EU or the US. It won't be available on the US site. It's just that in compliance with the regulation, the business information has to be available on your listings that you've made available to buyers in Europe, the European Union, and that shows up to anyone, regardless if they're a buyer that's registered in the EU or if they're a buyer that's registered in the US.
Just so I'm really clear on this, in the US, if I pop over to the German site and I don't log in and I'm kind of looking at items, even then would I be able to see it or do I have to log in?
Yeah, you're on the site.
So as long as I'm on the site, regardless of where in the world I am, I'm on the German site, the EU law is that information has to be provided to the consumer. That information then is visible.
That is the answer I got.
It makes sense. It's an EU regulation. So if you're on an EU site, then it would be visible. I'm sure we will get more questions about that in the weeks and months ahead.
Oh, I'm certain we will.
Well, our last question this week is from seller Sandy, who has what she believes is a good strategy for complying with the Digital Services Act, or DSA. Hi, guys. After a somewhat unsettling experience from another platform, no buyer will ever have access to my home address again. Fortunately, there is a way to be compliant with the new EU regulations for a physical address. I have a PO box.
Oh, no.
Oh, no is correct. And our postmaster posted a flyer showing how to have a physical address. You list the physical address of the post office and your box number as your suite number. This will also work for a box at the UPS store or similar type of business. Hope this helps. Sandy, RPB round two. Well, that's interesting, Griff.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And the only reason I included this is because it gives us the opportunity to say, oh, Sandy, please do not do this. And please do not suggest that anyone else do it.
Yes, the EU regulation requires a physical address, not a forwarding address or PO box. eBay requires that all business addresses be verifiable, and PO boxes are not.
And even if you're using this little trick that USPS has told you about using the physical address for the post office and then a suite number, they know that this is not your business address. They know that this is an address of a mail forwarding service or of a mail service itself, and it's not going to pass muster. And I can't stress this enough. Please, I really can't. There are serious consequences for changing your business address to one that cannot be verified, and the address of a post office and a suite number for your PO box cannot be verified by eBay systems. This has consequences, and it can be a stoppage of your payouts until you supply an address that is identical to your business address. And your business address should be the same as your billing address for your business, your checking account, whatever you're using to accept payments. If they are different, you risk having your payments stopped. So that's important. And your listings, your new listings starting next year could be blocked until you provide a verifiable business address in your business information.
So the upshot on this, Sandy, is do not change your business address to a PO box.
Or to even the address of the post office, yeah.
To the physical address, the post office with the PO box. If a seller absolutely does not want their business information available on their listings shown in the EU, the only option is to stop selling in the EU by putting the EU on your restricted list for shipping, and you can do that in your selling preferences.
Yeah, or you can create policies that have that.
Oh, that's right.
Look, I'm going to warn you right up front. If you do restrict the EU from your shipping policies, you're going to lose potential sales to EU buyers. eBay is not going to encourage this or recommend it because it's not good for anyone. But you can do this, and it is your decision to make. Each seller will have to make it on their own. But if you do, do so with caution. You don't want to impact your business negatively.
Will you still use international shipping, Griff?
Yeah, I will. I did go and change. Well, I had my email as my business email. I have a Gmail account that's directly related to my eBay account, so I'm not worried about that. And I did change my phone number to, I got a Google Voice number, and then I use that. My Google Voice number, it'll be the one that's displayed, and it will forward to my personal phone that I use all the time. Because I only have, like a lot of people, I have one cell phone. But I'm not worried about that because my phone number will never be displayed. I use my home address. And for me personally, I'm okay with it showing up for buyers who will go to the EU sites to see my listings. It's interesting because for me, if I'm using eBay International Shipping, 99% of what I'm selling is fragrance. So it's kind of a moot point for me because my listings are not going to appear in the EU. If I've set it up with eBay International Shipping, it's a disqualified category. So you can't ship fragrances through eBay International Shipping. So my listings don't show up on EU sites. What I do get are EU buyers coming to the US and finding my listings and saying, oh, won't you ship to like Germany? And I have to say, no, I don't. I'm sorry. It's just I only ship to domestically. So it's not as big a deal to me. But if it's a big deal to you and I don't want to, you know, invalidate somebody's concern about having their home address displayed, if you want to sell into the EU, that has to be there. And if you don't want it there, the only other option is to not sell into the EU, I guess.
We should also remind everyone that this new business information thing is due to a new EU law and was not something that eBay implemented on its own.
Yeah, right. We need to make that clear.
Well, and Sandy kind of referenced it where, you know, she made the comment about on another site. So regardless of what marketplace you're on, you're going to come across this.
All the big marketplaces or any marketplace is going to have to comply with this. If they have presence or they provide presence for their sellers on their platform into the EU, you're going to be impacted by this. It's not just eBay.
Well, it's a very different world, Griff, from the days of early eBay 25 years ago.
You think?
Paper checks, money taped to pieces of paper.
Yeah, it's internet's matured a little bit, like all of us. I mean, look at you and me. You don't look like your badge anymore.
I look exactly like my badge. Oh, wait. No, I don't.
No, you don't, Brian. So if you were wondering what we're talking about, if you work for a company like eBay for access purposes and other things, you have a badge and it has your photo on it. Most of us have, over time, either lost our badges or had them updated, so there's a recent picture on the badge. Brian is probably the only employee at eBay whose badge is the original picture from when he started working at eBay in 1999.
I'm not changing it unless they make me. My only regret in the photo is I'm not smiling. I kind of have just like a kind of a flat face, you know.
No, it's not flat. I've seen it. You look startled. You look like a deer in the headlight. Like, what did I get myself into?
Had I only known.
Well, I hope you update it someday. But we do get a lot of mileage out of that internally because you say, look at his badge. People go, who's that, your son?
Exactly.
Anyway.
Well, it reminds me of at one point I was youthful before I came to eBay.
Join the club. I want to make one more point before we go here. I think you got to prepare yourself because the maturation of the internet is not stopping. I mean, look at the sales tax thing. Look at
1099K.
Yeah. We're going to be subjected to increasing government regulation over time, and it's just going to continue. So you got to gird your loins if you're a business owner and just go with the flow because you can look forward to more regulation in the future.
And I agree with you 100%, Griff, but I will say this for sellers. You do have influence. If you're not a member of the eBay Main Street,
good point.
I encourage you to join ebay.com/Main Street and sign up. And if you see legislation, congressional leaders, the people that you elect, are more likely to listen to you than they are to eBay. Take advantage of that Main Street portal that we give you and the information that we provide you so that you're able to more easily connect with the folks that represent you in state and in federal government. Well, if you have a question about girding your loins or about selling on eBay, don't keep it to yourself. Call us on 888-723-4630.
That's 888-723-4630. And you can call that number at your convenience and leave a question or comment. And we love to get voice calls. Please call in your question. We'll put you on the air.
And if you're not a call on the phone person, You can always email us at podcast@ebay.com. That's podcast@ebay.com.
And you know you've been waiting this entire episode to hear it, so we won't hold off any longer. It's your 3-point podcast checklist for the week.
Check the announcement board at ebay.com/announcements for up-to-date seller news every day.
Number 2 is, now is the time to prepare for implementation of the EU's Digital Services Act by updating as needed any aspects of your public information. Go to My eBay account, public business info, and consider getting a business phone and email address separate from your personal phone and email.
And don't edit your business address to a PO box.
Good reminder there, Bri.
Need to review anything in this episode? It's easy. Check the transcript for this and all episodes for follow-up on what you've heard and to find the links we referenced during the episode.
And on our next episode, we'll be talking holiday shopping trends with eBay's Growth Senior Program Manager, Dallin McKee.
We'd like to again thank our guest this week, Tate Hudenpile of Hoodies Collectibles on eBay.
The eBay for Business podcast is produced and distributed by Libsyn and Podcast 411. See you next week, Brian.
See you, Griff.